Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Welcome back to the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength conditioning and strength conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. If you're a new listener, new to the podcast, welcome. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. Really appreciate you being here, spending your time with us. This is episode 151. We're talking with Dr. Herman Ponzer. He's the author of a new book called Burn. It's actually not super new. It's been out for a few months now, and I have been hyping it up since its release. I picked it up as soon as it came out. And one of my favorite science books that I've ever read. And I've been waiting for this book to come out because I've been reading Dr. Ponzer's work for some time now. And my brain exploded when I read the first paper by him on the constrained energy model. So we're going to be talking about metabolism, energy expenditure, much more on this week's podcast. One of my favorite episodes to record, edit, make, etc. So really excited for you guys to listen to this one. A few announcements first. Our two-day seminars are still going on. Our next one is in November at Alan Thrall's Gym, Untamed Strength in Sacramento, California. So if you ever wanted to train at Alan's gym, maybe meet Alan and go to Barbell Medicine Seminar, you can knock it all out in one weekend in November. So link to that in the show notes below as well. Also, I've been steadily feeding you guys some of this new apparel that's about to drop. We've got a bunch of new shirts, a bunch of new gear coming out. It should be up on the website, available for purchase next week. So stay tuned for that. And all right, without any further ado, let's hop into this week's podcast, episode 151, with Dr. Herman Ponzer.
Sure, I'm Herman Ponzer. I'm a professor at Duke and the author of a book called Burn, just came out this spring. And I'm an evolutionary anthropologist, and I focus on how our bodies evolved to burn energy.
I love it. Evolutionary anthropologist, for those who don't know what exactly that is, just a brief kind of overview of what that entails.
Yeah, sure. So anthropology is the study of humans, right? Which could be, obviously, that's a super broad, that's very broad. So it can be cultural, it can be, cultural studies, it can be archaeology, it can be linguistics, or it can be what I do, which is the sort of human biology aspect of our species, right? How did we evolve? How do our bodies work? And how does our sort of evolutionary past shape the way that they work today? And how do we understand both ourselves, but also differences among people, that kind of thing. So human diversity, human biology is a big focus in anthropology. And people who focus on those evolutionary questions like I do call ourselves evolutionary anthropologists. So my training is from that, looking at the human body from an evolutionary perspective, understanding how our deep past shapes the way that they work today.
Yeah, I think when reading the book Burn, it was heavily impressed upon me how much research that you're actually doing, like collecting data in the field. Mm-hmm. How much has been in the field versus in the lab at Duke, for example?
Yeah, I mean, it's in terms of my energy and it's about 50-50. In terms of the time, it ends up being, you do field trips to the field in the summers typically. You're constrained by that because if you're a professor like me, you got to teach. So you're teaching during the fall and the spring semesters. That takes up a lot of your time, and kind of getting your field work prepped, and then you go and try to bang it out in the summer months.
Yeah. Yeah, there's some really cool stories. So I'm like, I wonder if there's any sort of not a vacation, but maybe like a guided tour to Hadza Land. I'd love to go check that out.
Well, let me say this about that. So people have, contacted me about this, and the Hadza, who is the community we work with a lot, especially in the book, we talk a lot about the Hadza work. They are an amazing community of hunter-gatherers in northern Tanzania. And there are some, they live in camps kind of spread around this region of northern Tanzania near Lake Eyasi. And there are some camps that you can go to as a tourist and you can check them out. And I would just caution people who do that. If we run a charity called the Hadza Fund, HADZAFUND.org. And we have some suggestions on who you can go with if you want to do any kind of tourism with the Hadza, with groups that are really responsible about how they do it. Some groups are not as responsible. And so please do your homework before you go, because you can go and hang out with the Hadza for a bit, kind of learn about their lives and their culture, but do it responsibly, please.
Oh, I like that. Okay. And two things we ask all of our guests, what type of exercise do they prefer, and what book or books are they currently reading?
Oh, so my favorite kind of exercise is rock climbing. So I try to get out a couple times a week if I can, although that doesn't always happen. Sure. If I can't climb, I try to get out and run. That's my other thing. Mountain biking is also fun. Right now I'm reading, Carl Zimmer's, what is it? Life's Edge. I can't remember the title. I think it's Life's Edge or something like that. And it's a really good one. And I'm reading another book called Orphans of Davenport, which is all about how your body develops and your mind develops, and the early science behind figuring out that you know, IQ is not some static measure, but is actually this developmentally plastic trait. If kids are, you know, in environments that enrich them early on, you can have huge effects on IQ, which has been really fun to read that, all that history of that science.
I'll add those to my reading list.
Yeah.
Okay. So again, if you haven't read Dr. Ponser's book yet, Burn, it's definitely one of the ones we've been recommending on this podcast since it's come out. I wanted to have him on the podcast to actually talk about the main topic of that book, which is the constrained energy model. I came across this through one of your papers maybe two and a half years ago, and my mind exploded because there are difficulties in reconciling you know, differences in observed outcomes if you were using the additive model of just, you know, resting energy expenditure plus diet-induced energy expenditure plus activity energy expenditure. And you're like, okay, so it's probably not that simple, but I don't have a better way to explain it. And it seems like everybody was using this additive model. And still, even now, mm-hmm. you know, the mm-hmm. most calorie calculators, exercise science papers, etc. So just for our listeners, can you give us a background on what is the constrained energy model and how does this differ from the additive model?
Yeah. So again, the additive model is that if I think about all the tasks my body does every day, basal metabolic rate, you know, resting, digestion, and I take my laundry list of activities, walking, running, whatever I did that day, and I add up all those costs of all those activities, I can add them up and I'll get a real answer. I'll get the accurate, correct answer of how many calories I burned that day. And that additive model makes a very simple prediction, which is that if I am more active, I'll burn more calories than when I'm less active. Or if I compare really active populations, they'll have high energy expenditures. And if I look at, you know, compared to really sedentary populations. So the additive model makes intuitive sense. It's what everybody thinks is going on. It's what I thought was going on. And then what happened was I went and worked with the Hadza hunter-gatherer community. We were getting the first measurements of total energy expenditures in a hunting and gathering population. Humans evolved as hunter-gatherers, and so these living hunter-gatherer populations, there aren't many left, but they're these really kind of invaluable reference points, basically, for understanding human physiology in that kind of a lifestyle. And so they're super physically active. They get more physical activity in a day than most Americans get in a week. And so we measured energy expenditures with the Hadza, men and women, and we expected to see really high energy expenditures, lots of calories per day. And instead, what we saw was that their total energy expenditures are no different than Americans. That was total mind-blowing for me. I didn't expect that at all, you know, and so that was, it's always fun to be surprised as a scientist, but that was really remarkably surprising. And so I followed that up. So I looked at other human populations, data on other human populations. We've done studies within groups, you know, within populations, the active people in a group versus the inactive people in a group. We've looked at data on exercise interventions where you take somebody who's sedentary and you get them exercising. We've looked at this with mice and with birds and other species. And again, we get the same result, which is this. If you look at people who are sedentary versus active, there's not as much of a difference there in energy expenditure as you'd expect from how much exercise the active people are doing.
right? In other words, they're exercising maybe 200, 300 calories a day on average, kilocalories a day, but we're only seeing, maybe we're not seeing any difference at all in their energy expenditure, or if we do, it's tiny compared to what we'd expect from their activity levels. And so what that says to me as a biologist is that your body is actually working to constrain how many calories you're burning every day, that your body's adjusting to activity levels to kind of to tamp that down and keep your energy expenditure within a pretty narrow range. And that's the constrained energy hypothesis. That is that as you get more and more physically active, your body adjusts, spends less energy on other tasks, and keeps total energy expenditure within a pretty narrow band.
Yeah, it seems like, and where you go in further in the book is that there's kind of like this almost species specific, but still persistent like metabolic scope that there's a band in which different species live in, and trying to go outside of that for a long period of time is incompatible with long term with life. You know.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, I mean, if you can push it for a while. I mean, you know, the Tour de France, right? The Tour de France just wrapped up a few weeks ago. Those guys were not within any kind of normal human range of expenditure, you know, not forever. You can't do that forever. Sure. You know, Kona Triathlon, Western States, you know, 100 mile ultramarathon. You can do these things. We measured people who ran a marathon a day from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. in one of our studies. You can push that limit, right? You can extend it for a bit, but not forever. Your body will eventually bring you down. You'll stop either because you get injured or because you just wear out or whatever, and you'll be brought back down into that kind of narrow band.
Yeah, I think that's kind of where people, you know, they're going to push back a little bit. They say, "So wait, you're saying that if I do all of this exercise, all of this extra activity, my total daily energy expenditure is not going to really move that much?"
Yeah,
and there's just a little more nuance there. Is like, well, how much exercise are you going to do? Because if you're talking about a Tour de France type effort, ultra endurance type training, that's not really what you're talking about, but the normal range of sustainable human activity, which for some of us is like fairly active.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, it's probably not going to be as high as you think it is.
That's right. And people also get this piece of it wrong, which reflects me not phrasing it, you know, not articulating it well enough. So this is on me, but you know, people take that to mean, that day-to-day energy expenditure doesn't change. They say, are you telling me that I worked out today and tomorrow's a rest day and I'm going to have the same expenditure both days? No. That's not the point. The point is your body is adjusting, it looks like, sort of what's happening in the background. And it's adjusting to what it takes as your average amount of exercise. And so, you'll still have big days and small days, but that kind of background expenditure will either be higher or lower depending on how active you are. If you're really active, it'll be adjusted down to make room for that activity on average, sort of over, you know, you got to think of this over sort of week long or even longer time horizons.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense that there are probably multiple redundant sort of mechanisms to adjust energy expenditure to, again, make sure that we are able to reproduce and carry on our lineage. So if you had to summarize the data regarding the effect of exercise, so just formalized physical activity that's purpose-driven, and its effect on total daily energy expenditure, how would you explain that? I know you do it in the book, but you know, if people don't get that far.
Yeah. So when people start exercising, they start a new exercise program. At first, right before your body adjusts, then the additive model works great. And for those first few weeks, you are burning calories just like you'd expect if from a calorie calculator. But over time, what happens is your body adjusts and, you know, we're trying to pin down this number now, but somewhere around half of the energy that you're spending on the exercise, maybe even more, maybe close to 100% over a long enough period of time, your body will adjust. And now you're not burning more calories anymore than you were before you started the exercise program. So there are some really nice studies that show this. The Midwest exercise studies are a great example of this. They took, I think, 30 or 40 men and women, put them in an exercise program for 16 months, okay? Mm-hmm. It's supervised exercise. So they were watching them do their exercises every week. And their energy expenditures at the beginning, total daily energy expenditures measured with doubly labeled water, the gold standard for this, calories a day, was no different at 16 months after they've been doing all these exercises for 16 months as it was in the beginning. And then they followed this up with Midwest 2 and did more exercise intervention, and they showed some smaller, you know, they showed some effect at 10 months of exercise on total energy expenditure, but it wasn't what you'd, it wasn't as much as you'd predict. And about half the people showed no response at all in energy expenditure. They were the quote unquote non-responders.
Right.
And so, you know, that's kind of typical of the studies that have actually measured energy expenditures, is that you see that kind of tamping down of the, of expenditure to meet, to get you back closer to baseline after, after a few months. excuse me. So that's what happens. Now, Midwest 1 and Midwest 2 are also great examples of how important it is to exercise anyway. Okay. Mm-hmm. Because they showed really important positive effects on things like blood glucose levels, things like, you know, all your measures of cardiometabolic health and disease. It was really good for those people to be exercising. They did lose a bit of weight. Not much, but they lost some weight, especially at the beginning before their, as their bodies were adjusting. And that weight loss is good for them. You know, their cardiovascular fitness went up, VO2 went up, you know, VO2 max went up. So all these measures of health improved. Absolutely important. Exercise is really, really important. I want to make sure that we emphasize that. Right. It just didn't have the effect that we would have expected on total energy expenditure, and maybe as much as we'd expect on weight loss. Weight loss is pretty minimal. So, that's the kind of thing you can expect if you start an exercise program, and you should still absolutely do it. It just doesn't work the way you think it does.
Yeah, it does seem like one of the bigger criticisms that you would likely get from this is that people would then jump to the conclusion, well, Ponzer is saying just don't exercise because it may not be useful to help you lose weight, and it may not increase your energy expenditure as much as we would predict. But that's not, I mean, that's not the impression I got at all.
This is why scientists always hate journalists, which is that, you know, if you read my work, the clickbait title for your story, if you're a journalist, the clickbait title is "Don't bother exercising," or right. Scientists say exercise doesn't matter, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, God, my God, that's so frustrating. And you know, if you're me and you like talking to people and you like talking about science, then you just take your lumps, and that's life. And you're going to get miss you know, quoted or whatever. But no, that's not what we're saying at all. Exercise is super important. But what's really cool about this, actually, I think, is that exercise is important in this way that we hadn't appreciated before. Because mm-hmm. that metabolic adjustment that you make, right, is actually probably, we're pinning this down now with work right now, we think this is the reason that exercise is so good for you. That those adjustments you make, you know, if you're spending less on those kind of background processes to make room for that exercise, well, what are you spending less energy on? Well, you're spending less energy on inflammation, it looks like, because mm-hmm. inflammation levels go down. It looks like you're spending less energy on stress, right? Cortisol levels, epinephrine levels over the course of a day are reduced for people who exercise. It gets your reproductive hormone levels in a healthier place. And we know that exercise is a really important protective factor against reproductive cancers. So so those adjustments, it's hard to explain. It's hard to make sense of those adjustments without kind of understanding these energy trade-offs. So I think that the energy trade-off model, the constraint model, helps us understand those phenomena. And now we're trying to track down exactly at the cellular level how those switches all get switched. But we think this is a really important reason that exercise is so good.
Yeah, that's what I'm not sure which of the paper, your published papers that I was reading, where you had mentioned inflammatory processes being like having less available energy to like run amok. And I go, huh, interesting. Maybe that's one of the actual processes by which exercise becomes so health promoting, independent of some of the other things. In general, we think exercise, weight loss, body weight regulation, like excellent. But there's a host of other health promoting processes that occur independent of weight loss. And I think, if you could put a caveat or subtext on your, you know, whatever the journalist writes about burn, right. You said, they'd be like, you should exercise anyway, though, regardless of what it does.
For what it's worth, I say that to every journalist I talk to. So, if you're listening to this and you go and check out any of the public treatment of my work, you can grade the journalist on whether or not they included that in the story. Because I always say they don't always include it.
Right. Yeah. Just try to get you off the hook. How was Twitter when you published Burn? Were people, I mean,
wonderful and horrible, you know, isn't that what social media is? Yes. It's this dystopian future where you know, it's like the monkey's paw where you're like, I wish I could tell this to the world. You know, you can imagine yourself before social media. God, I got all this important stuff I'd like to say. I wish I could tell the world. And it's right. Like, oh, really? Is that really what you'd like? And so, you know, for somebody, again, as a scientist who likes to talk to people and likes to talk science, Twitter is amazing because you can talk about whatever new science you've done. And if people are excited about it, then you know, that's wonderful. Mm-hmm. But it also, you know, of course, the troll armies are all out there. So I've had two reactions that I think are frustrating for me. One is people who just don't want to believe that exercise isn't the best tool for weight loss. And they really hate the message from the book on this, which isn't just my message. It's the message from a lot of scientists over decades, which is that diet is a much better tool for managing weight. Exercise can have some benefits around the edges. It can help you keep weight off if you lose it, but diet's way better as a tool. And you know, the constrained energy model helps explain why. Yeah. So that's been frustrating. And some of those are colleagues of mine who work in exercise research, and they feel like I'm attacking them or something like that. And that misunderstanding hurts me. Yeah. I'm not trying to downplay their research or the importance of it. So anyway, that's frustrating. The other frustrating thing is the low carb, high fat folks, the keto bros, if that's a demographic, I think that's a demographic, right? I think that's on the new census data. New census data is out and keto bros are way up.
Yeah. 100%.
You know, look, as I say in the book, all diets for weight loss work the same way. And they work by cutting how many calories you eat and making the calories you eat less than the calories you burn. And that should not be controversial. The fact that that's controversial only tells you how backwards the diet industry has gotten itself and how twisted in knots it's gotten. Keto diets and low carb diets in general, they work really well for some people. And I've never said don't do it. What I've said is it works the same way as other diets work, which is it cuts how many calories you eat. Because guess what? It's actually hard to overeat. Your brain will feel will tell you that you're full and done if you take half the menu away, right? You mm-hmm. can't overeat. And this is true about any kind of diet. If you only eat potatoes, this has been done, and I'm not recommending this, but people, if you only eat potatoes, you will lose weight like crazy. All it is starch, but you'll lose weight like crazy because how many potatoes can you eat before you go, I'm done with potatoes, right? Yeah. How much steak? I love steak too. How much steak can you eat before you're like, yeah, I'm full. I'm done. Mm-hmm. And there's no dessert course, right? There's no ice cream because you're low carb. Good for you. That's great. And they feel, well, there are people whose entire livelihoods, especially in the weird fad diet world, their entire livelihoods are based on keto. And so any attack on that is an attack on them. And you know what? Good for them. Because if you're selling fad diet charlatan stuff, then you deserve to be attacked. That's not good science. I'm sorry. And if you are out there listening and you're on a keto diet and it's working for you, fantastic. Nobody's happier for you than me. But there's no magic. It's you're cutting calories.
Yeah, you've effectively changed the food environment enough to gain control over this appetite satiety relationship, and now are eating in either a calorie deficit, energy balance deficit, if you're losing weight, mm-hmm. or you've now lost the weight and are maintaining a new, healthier, more appropriate energy reserve.
That's right.
Yeah, so it's very interesting stuff. I would imagine, you know, the interesting thing is if you were, I scoped your Instagram as well, and I was like, all right, good. He's not really on Instagram like that as
much. Yeah.
Safe. So Instagram, here's the spectrum. YouTube's the worst place, except for maybe TikTok now. It's just like TikTok maybe worse than YouTube. Then it's Instagram. And Twitter is interesting because you do have a lot of academics and actual professionals on there.
Right.
And so we have people who have huge Instagram followings, huge YouTube followings who will post just nonsense over and over and over again. And on those platforms, they get all this positive like social credit from people who don't know anything, you know, but are excited about the content. But then on Twitter, they'll post the same thing and just get hammered by actual professionals. And it's just so interesting to see this. I'm like, if people just came over to Twitter a little bit more often.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I think it's the visual versus the text, right? I mean, because Twitter is real. You can put pictures on Twitter, but mostly it's words. And Instagram's the opposite. And I love Instagram to scroll through, but whenever I want to say something on Instagram, I'm like, I wish I had a pretty picture for this.
Right. You'll have to hire a photographer.
So I think it's easy to kind of, be visually interesting and compelling and be kind of light on the details on Instagram would be my guess. Would be my guess.
And then TikTok's directly related to your dance skills, I guess, right. or choreography. Right. Yeah. Getting back to the constrained energy model. So I think we have a good understanding in this podcast, at least about what it is and kind of what its findings are. Two interesting questions. The first one I'll lead off with on the NIH's website, they have this body weight sort of calculator, like how many calories are you going to need? And there's like expert mode and you can plug in all this data. One interesting feature of that I wanted to get your opinion on is they have this physical activity level sort of modifier. Mm-hmm. Effectively, you plug in a value based on your current activity level and it multiplies by your BMR.
Yeah.
I have been telling people, and you can just, we'll put this on the podcast. I've been telling people to just pick, you know, either lightly active or moderately active and just leave it as just a hedge. Like you're probably somewhere in this range. But I don't think that there are people who are sustaining this extreme level of activity. Yeah. Well, right. So just how would you modify that formula if you could?
Yeah. So that calculator was developed largely by my good friend and colleague and extremely smart guy, Kevin Hall. He's wonderful. And he is that is no fluff. That is real hard nutrition science right there. So it's fantastic. The one thing that he and I disagree with is the value of putting that physical activity modifier in. I would just say keep it at 1.7, maybe 1.8, and you're probably as accurate as you'll ever be. That's what I would say about that. I don't think Kevin disagrees, but I think he would want to have some input about lifestyle on there. There's some, lifestyle can have a tiny effect, but it just isn't as big as people think. So people think, I exercise all the time. I'm going to, and it's going to be a ratio of 2 or 2.1, to your BMR. Nope, almost surely not. So that's what I was. I think your advice is pretty good. Keep it at that moderate activity level and just kind of ignore that piece of it.
Let the record show Dr. Ponzer agrees with me now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think a lot of that had to do with probably occupational energy, occupational activity that has changed over the years. But yeah, I mean, if you're a jute mill worker and you're active all day.
I will tell you that comes directly from the additive model. And it's because, so what happened was after World War II, there was a renewed interest in trying to understand nutritional needs. And this is, in the aftermath of all these horrors of war, of course, the Holocaust, of course, but also, other POW situations, other starving populations. And there was really well-intentioned science, applied science and nutrition behind trying to understand what people need to survive and how to keep people fed. Really important work. They had no technique. There was no method available on how to measure total energy expenditure over 24 hours, outside of a laboratory. If you had somebody in a laboratory, you could do it. But normal daily life, you couldn't. And so that's when this physical activity ratio, additive model stuff developed. And we've just accepted it. It was the best you could do at the time. We've moved on beyond that, actually. Now we know that we know better. But, old habits die hard. So people have these in their calculators.
A spinoff of that, it's this new paper by Willis et al. Titled Physical Activity and Total Daily Energy Expenditure in Older U.S. Adults. Seemingly found that when individuals increase their exercise, their physical activity, but where we're eating a surplus of calories, although I would actually probably say more maintenance level because they weren't losing weight they weren't gaining weight rather, that the most appropriate model was this additive model. That's kind of one of the conclusions the authors came to. And if they were in a negative energy balance, and we're actually losing weight, it kind of more approached this constrained model. do you feel like that is included in your constrained energy model, or that's more of like an added bit of nuance?
Yeah. So I'm on that paper actually.
Yeah.
and you know, this is part of being a scientist is, do you hide from data that don't, you know, screamingly support your model, or do you say, yeah, these are the data, and you know, we'll look at the accumulated evidence. I know Eric Willis, who did that study. Well, we talked a lot about the data, and he invited me to come on and help look at the data with him, which was awesome. Yeah, you're right. In that sample of those adults, those older adults, the additive model seems to do a better job predicting. I still think the constrained model. So for example, if you look at people who have very low energy expenditures in that study, like zero, their daily energy expenditures are higher, much higher than you'd expect from just their sort of basal metabolic rate plus digestion. So those people at the very low end are burning more energy than you'd expect from their physical activity. And the an increase in total expenditure goes up more slowly than I think you'd expect with physical activity. So mm-hmm. That's the caveat that's how I would interpret those data. But, you know, we'll see. And if over lots of more studies, I still think that the data are in my favor overall. But hey, well, that, you know, this is science. We test it. So we'll see.
Yeah. I think, you know, for people listening to this and they're like, wait, it all doesn't just fit the model. It's like, well, there's going to be inter-individual variation in how you respond to physical yeah. activity and your energy expenditure, and particularly the time course is going to be super important too. So if this study was carried out over longer periods of time, you might expect it to converge back
in. So, and one thing that they didn't have in that study was resting metabolic rate measurements. Mm-hmm. They didn't have that. And so if they had that, you could see the people who are more physically active have reduced resting metabolic rates, which would be a prediction of the model, regardless of what the top line number of calories is doing. We don't have that. So we can't know that actually from that study. So I call that study, I think it's important data. I'm glad they put it out. I was glad to be, you know, included in it. And we'll see. It doesn't change my opinion of where the data sit overall.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a bunch of other papers that come out kind of like that. And you're like, all right, we're missing
something. Yeah, we're missing something. Yep.
One of the interesting sort of, I guess, end points of this constrained energy model that I'm fascinated by is this very high exercise volume, you know, sort of response in that people can adjust down their total daily, their other elements of energy expenditure to keep their TDEE down. But it seems like this occurs if they're not able to eat enough food to like sustain their body weight and sustain that energy expenditure. So there's like alimentary or gut, you know, limit to how much they can actually eat, which has this knock-on effect of regulating their energy expenditure. You talk about that in the book a little bit, and you know, I want to save some of that for people who haven't read your book. But how high of like exercise volumes are we talking, like before you reach this point where it's like you might not be able to eat enough to like sustain your energy?
Yeah, so that's a slightly different piece of this. This would be applicable to people who are, you know, kind of in the elite level of athletic, you know, in terms of training. Maybe you don't compete, but you're doing that kind of workload weekly. Mm-hmm. This is going to be relevant for you. We have data from really high end, you know, really extreme events, energy expenditure in those events, like the Tour de France, like Ironman triathlons, like ultramarathons, people doing Arctic trekking. And these folks that I talked about that ran from Los Angeles to DC, I mean, you know, really high end stuff, that there is this limit in how well your body can absorb calories, right? So if you look at people in these studies, like the Tour de France, like the people who ran from LA to DC, first of all, let's talk about the metabolic ceiling. If you look at how long those events last, and how high they were able to keep their metabolic rates, you see this sort of sloped ceiling. So you can make, you know, it's analogous to sprinting versus running marathons, right? You can keep a really high expenditure for a couple of days. The energy expenditure you can maintain for a month is going to be lower than that. The amount you can maintain for 3 months is going to be lower than that. And so as you go longer and longer, that metabolic ceiling kind of gets lower and lower and crunches you down. Where it levels out, where we think that if you really push yourself, you could probably push up to this maximum level. That maximum level we think we could maintain forever, indefinitely, is at about 2.5 times your basal metabolic rate. Now, why do we say it that way? Well, because small people are going to have smaller systems, right? Smaller guts, smaller livers. Big people are going to have bigger systems. And so if you're, and basal metabolic rate kind of tracks that, how big your system is, right? So it's going to be size adjusted. For somebody my size, I'm about 6 feet, 165 pounds. My limit would be something like 4,500 calories a day. That'd be about 2.5 times my basal metabolic rate. So, and what we think is if you go above that, your body actually can't get energy in fast enough to replenish what you burned that day. Mm-hmm. And so you can do that for a while and you'll lose weight while you're doing it, but your body, you can't lose weight forever, obviously. And so the long-term limit is about 2.5 times basal metabolic rate. And we're doing some testing now to see if that holds with ultramarathon athletes and that kind of stuff, because we're curious if that result that we got from this kind of statistical analysis of people in these extreme events holds up when we look individually and see if we can track people and see if that really does work for them. But right now that's the current hypothesis.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just really interesting to me, particularly coming from a sports nutrition, background, where it's like one of the big drivers of these, particularly in extended events, is how fast can you get food in and how well does your gut tolerate it without getting sick? And so there's this huge, again, inter-individual variation. And then I'm like, oh, wait, there's a limit here too. That's a whole nother piece that we didn't even really consider.
That's right. Isn't the Tour de France called a month-long eating contest on bikes? And I think that's probably pretty accurate. Well, and you must see this a lot because, in sports nutrition, it's a kind of a specialized part of the nutrition spectrum, as you know, and you're dealing with people who are pushing their bodies in interesting ways. Another piece of the constrained energy model that I think is relevant here is that if you're doing lots and lots of exercise and you're taking energy away from other tasks and there's some limit to how much energy you can put in, at some point you're going to get to this sort of overtraining space or REDS, right? Reduced energy deficit syndrome. And it's not because, you don't have enough power bars and the Gatorade. It's because you just can't put the energy in fast enough. So exercise is taking too big of a share, right? And it's leaving not enough for immune system and other stuff. So is that an experience that you've had with people you've worked with?
Yeah, relatively. We're more in the just the bulk of the people we work with end up being in strength sports. And so to the extent overtraining syndrome exists in strength sports, it's never been described in the literature. People have tried, you're going to max out on squat and bench press every day for the next 12 weeks. And we're going to try to overtrain you. And it turns out they just get stronger. The ones who can, sustain that and not get injured. So if you call injury,
because the calorie workload isn't enough. Is that the idea? Because muscles will fatigue before you actually burn that many calories.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. You don't. Yeah. The energy expenditure during resistance training is just it's very low. And so when people are like, how many carbs do I need to replenish? And it's just not that much, a couple sticks of gum, eat your protein for most people. Yeah. Obviously high volume training is different, but we see it a lot in, weight class sports, particularly people who are actively trying to lose weight and reduce body fat to be more competitive, physique sports at very low body fat levels. And then there's this interesting interplay in men who have very high training volumes, in the CrossFit space, who are also very lean and just, they're training two or three times a day. There's REDS on the one side. So people are symptomatic and having all these, issues with regulating their endocrine system, their immune system, and psychologically. And then there's this condition called exercise hypogonadal condition of the male. An isolated endocrine issue, but no real symptoms. And so you're like, well, wait, which one's pathological or both pathological? Are they both? Is this a transient thing that people go into REDS? Is it kind of MH? Anyway, so it's fascinating to me. But in general, yeah, when people try to sustain these very high workloads, particularly at very, very low body fats, which is regulating their energy intake, it can be difficult. Thankfully, I don't see it too much, because trying to get people to change their behavior, particularly in this space, is difficult, because they're like, I got to win. I have this set window of where I can be competitive in my life in this particular endeavor.
Right.
So what are you telling me? And I'm like, well,
yeah. Well, the hypogonadal condition is interesting. I think it's a really nice example of, you know, pushing exercise too far, and exactly what this energy trade-off thing would predict. Right. I mean, Anthony Hackney, who's done a lot of work in this with men, low testosterone levels, and especially in endurance athletes. I think it speaks to how we talk about what's normal, and we talk about what human physiology is, and when it's pathological, we talk about a binary between, oh, you're healthy or you're sick. And, you know, human physiology rarely works like that. Infectious disease, that's a different thing. You either infected or you're not, but non-infectious disease, non-infectious issues, it's a spectrum. If you are, the more exercise you, if you're completely sedentary, your body's burning all this energy on stuff like inflammation that it shouldn't do. You start exercising and you take energy away from that, and that's healthy. You exercise too much and you take too much energy away from those tasks, and now you're sick, right? So it's a spectrum, and there isn't going to be a hard, clean, no, now you're sick, now you're healthy. You just have to think about it in this sort of trade-off spectrum way. I think that's more useful.
Yeah, no, I like that a lot. We had a seminar this past weekend in San Antonio, Texas, and one of the questions we got was about coronary artery calcium scoring, so CAC scoring, and how useful is this to predict atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease risk? And it's interesting, the dichotomy between, like, you know, people who have normal levels of physical activity and those with very, very high levels of physical activity. So marathoners, ultra marathoners, people completing over 3,000 met minutes of activity per week, their CAC scores are through the roof comparatively, very high. And people are like, wait, what? It's like, well, they're not really at an increased risk of cardiovascular disease. It's just what we're seeing is what some of these adaptive processes to that level of exercise volume, which is maybe it's at some level related to the constrained energy model, like what it would predict. I'm sure if you go back far enough, right?
Sure.
But it's just the body is very resilient and adaptable. And I think a lot of the things we see downstream, we try to make sense of without really knowing, you know, what does this whole spectrum look like from?
Yeah. And I would say this is also another reason that it's so fun to have walked into this space as an evolutionary anthropologist, because concepts of what's normal physiology, you know, what's a random sample of humans? Well, let me ask you. I don't know. It's not the people that you're going to find in a gym. Those aren't random. Yeah. It's not the average guy on the street, because guess what? The average guy on the street is, you know, in this country, typical guy is, you know, American, first of all, and raised in this culture and in this food environment. And that's not normal for humans at all. Normal for humans is hunting and gathering, actually. So, you know, although it's not normal today culturally across the world, that's physiologically what we're adapted to do. So, I think that was really a really fun part of writing the book, and just in my work in general, is kind of pushing people to rethink what's normal. And I think that's a useful exercise.
No, I like that. Just a quick comment on your latest paper, because I want people to go read this. If they're not subscribed to Science, we'll put a link in the description below. This is a cool paper. It's about daily energy expenditure through the human life course.
Yeah.
So, okay. One, where did all this data come from? And then what's your takeaway from this?
So this was a big collaborative effort, and I want to shout out John Speakman, who led the push to get all these labs to play together, including ours. So all the labs internationally that work with this method called doubly labeled water, which is the way that you measure 24-hour energy expenditures in people. We all agreed to put our data into a central database, the DLW database, and you can check it out online if you want. It's a freely available tool for scientists. Anyway, we got now 6,500. I think the latest version of it is 7,000 people, but the version in this paper had 6,400 people from 8 days old to in their 90s. And we were able to measure energy expenditures from, you know, with the gold standard method, and ask how does it change across your lifespan? And the answer is, well, as you grow bigger, you burn more energy because big things burn more energy than small things. Okay, so we knew that, but we were able to really characterize that relationship really well so that we could ask the next question, which is, after you account for body size, taking body size out of the equation, how do metabolic rates change? And that answer is really cool because it turns out when you're born, you know, babies are born like tiny adults in terms of their metabolisms, right? They look up like a piece of mom, which makes sense because that's where you've been. And then, but very quickly, your metabolic rate kind of kicks into gear and shoots up. And so, you know, yes, you're growing and getting bigger, but even in addition to that, you are burning more calories than you'd expect. And your cells are incredibly busy with growth and developmental processes. You peak out at about a year and then you slowly glide down to until you're 20 years old. So there's this really long elevated metabolic rate period that peaks in early childhood. And then you are rock stable from 20 to 60 years old. So all these people, you know, well, let me just finish this up. And then after 60, you decline. So it was really fun because I think people expected to see some age effects. The amount of age effects that we see are bigger than I would have expected. So they're really dramatic, actually. And they don't happen when you think they should happen. So we don't see a puberty effect, right? Mm-hmm. We don't see a menopause effect. We don't see, I hit my 30s and 40s and my metabolism is slowing down. That old, you know, that idea that's out there, like a lot of ideas about metabolism, they're just somehow out there in the ether, but aren't based on reality. So isn't that exciting and fun? And it's this sort of fundamental roadmap of how the body works over a lifetime that hasn't not at all been clear before. And so to work on something that's that kind of basic is really fun.
Yeah, isn't it? It's wild to me because when I read the paper, I was like, wait, does this not exist? How are we this far along in, you know, we're talking about all these esoteric concepts, not concepts, but whatever. There's all this stuff that seems far advanced other than the basic question, like, hey, I wonder what the metabolic rate does throughout like life. Like just
I remember, you know, so when the HADSA stuff, when we first published the HADSA stuff, this is a HADSA hunter-gatherer energetic expenditure stuff. We had to, of course, correct for body size in that analysis, right? Because they're a small statured folks. So, like, you know, average height for men is like 5.5 feet. So they're, you know, you have to correct for body size, obviously, to make it an apples-to-apples comparison. And so I was kind of new to this sort of work. I had done walking and running energetics before. I had done stuff across species, but I hadn't done human total daily energy expenditures before that work. And so I was collaborating with really great people in this space, Bill Wong. And I said, guys, how do we, so, you know, I'm a biologist. I know you have to correct for body size. I do this in my other work all the time. For this work, what's the best way to do it? And there was actually no consensus on the best way to correct for body size, on the best way to correct for age, right? And I couldn't believe it. I could not believe it. And so, that was my astonishment, the same as yours astonishment was reading this paper. And the answer is we really didn't have a good idea about how it worked. We knew the basics. We knew big people burn more calories than small people, right? Yeah. We thought there probably was an age effect. But to really characterize it and get the roadmap, that's like saying, well, I think, you know, I think that Pennsylvania is somewhere north of me. And I think that, you know, Japan is west if I go far enough. Like, okay, yeah, that's true. Not super useful. So, you know, this is like a real roadmap with actual, the details laid out.
Yeah. We're going to have to update all the nutrition texts, their metabolism sections. It's going to be like the third or fourth sentence. And here's in general what metabolism does throughout the lifetime. And there'll be a chart. But until now, yeah, people were just kind of guessing, maybe not too inaccurately, but like, where was the reference? Yeah. And then how do we kind of come to this? So,
Here's one thing that anybody who's listening here can think about. The test. If the people you're talking to about metabolism know about this work or have taken this on board, if they divide calories by kilograms or calories per pound and they use that as a way to correct for size, quote unquote, you know that they don't know what they're talking about. Because it's not that simple. It's not a one-to-one relationship. That's one of the things that we were able to show. When you correct for body size, when you show the body size versus expenditure relationship, it's not one-to-one. It's a curved relationship. There's this thing in biology called Kleiber's Law, which is this relationship between expenditure and body size across species. Within humans, we kind of fit that same kind of curvature. Point being, people who are very different in body size will inherently have, just by having differences in body size, will inherently have a different ratio of energy to pounds or energy to kilograms. And so if you think that you've corrected for size with that simple ratio, then you don't know what you're talking about. Sorry. Doesn't work that way.
Gauntlet thrown, shots fired.
Boom.
Which leads us to the perfect way to wrap this up. All right. So if people are offended by that, if they feel triggered, how can people interact with you on the internet?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Well, please do, because, you know, it's conversations are sad when it's only one person. So I'm always happy to talk science, and I really have fun with this, and I hope people do too. Twitter is the easiest way to get me on social media. You can find me in my lab at Duke online. And of course, I hope they'll read the book, Burn. A lot of this stuff is in there, and it's my plea to the world to please understand how human metabolism actually works. And then it's not a diet book. It's not an exercise book. It's a how does your body work book. And I hope people will take that and run with it.
10 out of 10, would recommend. We'll put links to the book and his social media platforms in the description below. Dr. Ponser, thank you so much for coming on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. I really enjoyed it.
That was fun. Thanks. Anytime.
All right. That's a wrap on episode 151 with Dr. Herman Ponser. A big shout out to him for coming on our podcast. Really enjoyed our chat. I've linked his book in the show notes, as well as the papers that we discussed in this podcast. All of those are in the show notes, so check those out. And hey, before you go anywhere, leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can bring you the latest nuance in health and fitness. Thanks for spending your time with us. We'll see you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. See ya.
Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.